Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, the first day of July, welcome, welcome, welcome on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman Arendt.
So the U.S. Supreme Court saved one of its biggest decisions for last, a ruling that says a president cannot erase birthright citizenship with the stroke of a pen, but that was only one part of a term that may reshape daily American life for years to come. The court gave presidents more power to fire officials at independent agencies. It allows states to bar transgender girls from girls' sports teams. It lifted limits on political parties spending money with candidates, and it made it harder in several cases for people to go to court when they say their rights have been violated. So what is the through line through all of this and all of these rulings? Today, we'll be joined by two constitutional law scholars who will help us unpack these rulings, the surprises, and what this term basically tells us about the future of the court, the future of the Constitution, right?
Mm-hmm. And future of the country.
The country, absolutely. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. What is your reaction to the U.S. Supreme Court rulings this term? And which decision do you think will have the biggest impact? And of course, we'd love to hear your reasons why. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can leave your comments in the chat. And Avi, this is one term that the birthright citizenship thing, everybody was paying attention to that.
Yeah.
Even folks who typically don't follow the court, they're like, what?
Right.
You know, so all sorts of questions came to a head this Supreme Court term.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what people are thinking out there. 888-477-9499. The email again is studio2@whyy.org. Also, before we jump into our trio of local news stories, it is another giveaway Wednesday.
Ooh.
Every Wednesday this summer, we're giving out tickets to an upcoming event in the region. Stick around to the end of the show for the reveal of this week's Giveaway Wednesday and for your chance to win.
And we've had some good giveaways too, so worth sticking around.
I know what this one is, and I believe it's quite worth it.
Yes, quite worth it. So stick around.
First, though, our trio of local news stories. We have to start with the weather. It's the big story locally this week. It's going to be dangerously hot for the next few days in Philadelphia, and it would be hard to imagine worse timing for this.
Oh, no.
Philadelphia has declared a heat emergency that starts at 1 o'clock today, runs through 8 p.m. Saturday.
Mm.
And here are the latest forecasted highs for Philadelphia, according to weather.com. 97 today, 104 tomorrow, 104 Friday, 101 Saturday.
That's hot.
The National Weather Service said this could be the hottest period for the region since 2011. And this comes just as the city is set to host, you know, tons of events for July 4th. There's also FIFA Fan Fest and a big FIFA match on Saturday, July 4th. Some events have already changed locations or times, so I would double check your plans if you're planning to attend any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just worth emphasizing that heat waves are some of the most dangerous forms of extreme weather, especially for folks who are already vulnerable. And we talk a lot about the high temperatures, but folks, keep an eye on the low temperatures as well, because in some of these days coming up, the lows probably will not even get below 80. And those night periods are when our bodies are able to recharge and regenerate. And if you don't have that break, it can be very dangerous. So check on yourself and check on those around you.
Yeah, and we have resources on how to remind yourself and the people around you to stay safe. You can go to whyy.org. By the way, that FIFA Fan Fest, we were up there, and it could get really hot up there. They do have cooling stations and other things, and they had already hit 250,000 visitors.
Yes.
You know, breaking all kinds of records and things like that. So, you know, hopefully this won't dampen attendance. People can at least attend at night when it's a little bit cooler.
Yep.
Hopefully people will pay attention to themselves. Heavy sweating, intense thirst, muscle cramps, dizziness, fatigue, rapid pulse, all things you need to be paying attention to. If you feel that way, you could be overheating. So make sure to take care of yourself.
Yeah, be safe. And by the way, one impact of the heat wave will be train delays. SEPTA has reduced operating speeds because heat can cause signal issues. And that gets us into our next story, Jerry.
Yeah, in addition to the heat, we had some other stuff to worry about. Believe it or not, there were two train derailments in our region over the past couple of days. The most recent, which took place early this morning, that's causing major delays on SEPTA. But I want to start with the first train derailment, right? That one took place Tuesday afternoon in Feasterville, Pennsylvania. 16 cars from a 72-car train derailed between Street Row and Neshaminy Station. Two of the cars had hazardous materials. Luckily, there was no leak. No one was injured, but authorities still had some residents in the area evacuate or shelter in place. Those orders have since been lifted, but freight transportation company CSX, they're leading the cleanup effort there. The pictures were kind of crazy because you literally had 16 cars off the tracks and all kind of bumping into each other. They said that they have crews, they are working to as safely and as quickly as possible to restore that impacted site. There's also an investigation underway, and SEPTA is bypassing the Neshaminy Station to avoid that area. So if you live in that area, you use that station, you're probably going to have to reroute yourself. The second train derailment happened early this morning, and that involved a SEPTA train. Apparently, an outbound Manayunk-Norristown line train derailed just after midnight near 16th Street. That's near Broad Street Station. No one was injured again, but there's also an investigation as to why this happened. In the meantime, SEPTA service is disrupted. The Manayunk-Norristown, Fox Chase, and Chestnut Hill East lines are suspended. There's also other lines that will be bypassing certain stations. So be sure to check out the SEPTA website if you're using Regional Rail to see if your routes have been impacted. And all of this, as you mentioned, as we get a heat wave, right? As the tracks are going to be affected.
And all these visitors, and we're trying to move people around the region. Yeah,
it's but that happened. But if you didn't know, and if you're not living, you wouldn't even have known that this derailment happened. But it's a pretty big deal.
Absolutely. Yeah. So thankfully, no one hurt in either derailment, but obviously a big mess to clean up. Finally, third story before we get you out of here and on to the main segment today. Big scoop by the Philadelphia Business Journal.
Uh-oh.
Give me that big scoop drum roll. According to their industry sources, Philadelphia is getting its third Trader Joe's and its first outside Center City. Wow.
Yes. Well, this is a win.
You are pumping your fist.
This is a win. I'm pumping my fist. Yeah.
The Biz Journal says this Trader Joe's will be located on Columbus Boulevard in South Philadelphia, not far from the big box stores down there. Next door to a Giant, by the way. Watch out, Giant. Competition coming. Trader Joe's would not confirm or deny this report by the Business Journal.
I wonder why.
However, it seems that this store could open toward the end of 2027. Trader Joe's will reportedly be the anchor tenant for a whole new shopping center right there on Columbus Boulevard. And this is part of a broader effort to, you know, spruce up the waterfront, help it transition from industrial, post-industrial to some sort of, you know, mixed-use shopping, living area. So it was funny. We were talking about this as, you know, part of our pre-show chat. And there was some skepticism that the installation of a single Trader Joe's is truly a story.
It is a story.
But at the same time, a bunch of us were going kind of nuts.
I know. I was one of the people going nuts. I love Trader Joe's. Full disclosure, I got to, you know, as a journalist, I'm going to disclose that.
We don't have any brand endorsements with Trader Joe's. But it is. Well, here's the thing. This is what they're so smart about. Trader Joe's only opened two stores so far in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
They make you kind of like beg for it, and then all of a sudden they give you one more.
They breadcrumb you.
You lose your mind.
They breadcrumb you. Remember,
because
they breadcrumb you, and I tell you, because the lines at the I remember we had one Trader Joe's. The lines used to be long.
Yeah.
Just getting in the parking lot. Yeah. The line, you had to wait.
And then they added one more, but it was really close to the original one, and everyone was like, "What the heck?"
Yeah. And then again, there are lines when you go to Trader Joe's.
Huge
although,
lines.
Shout out to Trader Joe's, you know, cashiers.
They move you.
They move you through, so you're not mad.
They're moving. The little bells ringing. They're moving.
They let you go. But, you know, you talked about Giant, and I don't think there's going to be any competition because
you think they can coexist.
I shop at different stores. Yes.
And this is a kumbaya moment. Giant and Trader Joe's can coexist.
Trader Joe's has stuff that Giant doesn't have.
Yeah.
Sorry, Giant.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. Because Trader Joe's doesn't sell a lot of those brand names. So you need to go to Trader Joe's separately from your trip to Giant. So you can go to both.
Yeah. Now, you don't actually live in South Philly, but you're going to go to this Trader Joe's.
Because they got on the weekends.
Yes.
On the weekends. During the week, you can go downtown.
Now, during the week, I'm going to go because I live close to it. So I don't have to deal with people like you coming from outside the neighborhood jamming up the store.
I'm going to jam it up. I'm just letting you know in advance.
I stopped going to Trader Joe's for years because there was only two in Philly.
Yeah.
And it was too much effort. And then I finally, my wife and I, we were in, I think it was Jenkintown or something recently. And just, I went to a Trader Joe's for the first time in a while. And I was like, dang, it is good.
You miss Trader Joe's.
Dang, it's good.
Get those ginger cookies, man.
They got the frozen pot stickers. Man.
It's so good. So anyway, shout out.
It's freaking worth it.
We'll be there in 2027.
But they haven't confirmed or denied. They have not confirmed or denied.
So it's a wink and a nod.
Let's
not
get our hopes up, folks.
We'll be there.
But also get your hopes up. At least get your hopes up for the next segment. We're talking about the Supreme Court. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. Not sponsored by Trader Joe's. We're not.
Nope.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The U.S. Supreme Court dropped a bunch of big decisions yesterday before their summer vacation. The term ended with a highly anticipated ruling on birthright citizenship. The justices overturned President Trump's efforts to end it in a 6-3 vote.
Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the majority saying, quote, "Citizenship then and now was the right to have rights, to freely participate in our political community. The framers of the 14th Amendment extended that promise to every free-born person in this land. We keep that promise today." And today on the show, we're going to dig into that opinion and the other major rulings of the term.
Yeah, we'll talk about the rulings on mail-in ballots, the president's firing power, state bans on transgender athletes, campaign spending, and temporary protective status for asylum seekers. Lot to get to. And to help us make sense of it all, we've got two constitutional law scholars. We have Kate Shaw, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania and co-host of the Strict Scrutiny podcast. Kate, welcome back to Studio 2. It's great to have you.
Oh, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Yes. And we also have Jeffrey Rosen, a law professor at George Washington University, the CEO emeritus of the National Constitution Center and author of The Pursuit of Liberty. Jeffrey, so great to have you.
Great to be with you. And Kate.
And it's great to have our listeners as well. We want to hear from you. What's your reaction to the Supreme Court decisions this term? What ruling do you think will be the most consequential? Give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
And Kate Shaw, Jeffrey Rosen, we just want to jump right in and start talking about these cases because there's so many to cover. And I want to start with birthright citizenship. This was the big one. And a lot of people thought that this ruling would be 9-0. That it was pretty clear what the Constitution said, but it was 6-3 and really 5-4 when it comes to the 14th Amendment's, conversation around this issue. I want to get your reaction to this ruling and just sort of your take on what it all means. And Kate, we'll start with you.
Sure. And you're exactly right, Cherry. It was 6-3 in that the president didn't have the power to implement this executive order. But on the critical constitutional question, whether the Constitution guarantees birthright citizenship, it was only 5-4. And in some ways, that is the most important takeaway from this opinion. It's, of course, critically important for the many, many individuals whose lives would have been completely upended if the president had been allowed to put into effect this order ending birthright citizenship going forward. It wouldn't have had retroactive effect, but for babies born in the United States to either undocumented or temporary visa holder parents, they would no longer have enjoyed birthright citizenship. So a huge sigh of relief for anyone who would have been directly impacted. But I also think that the vote was unbelievably close.
Yes.
And if you think that this language in the Constitution and everything in our tradition is clear, and this should have been a 9-0 opinion turning away this effort by President Trump. It's actually a really alarmingly close vote, and I think that in some ways it's going to embolden those who want to end birthright citizenship to try to take another run at doing it.
Yeah, and Jeffrey Rosen, would love to get your take on this and just the idea that Kate sort of, you know, poses, because, you know, we've heard that the quest to overturn birthright citizenship won't end. At least that's the promise from many people on the right. Your take on this ruling?
Well, Kate is absolutely right that it was a surprise. Many people expected it to be 7-2 or unanimous. And what's so striking is that the historical theory that Justice Thomas adopted in his 93-page dissent really just arose a couple of months ago from the Legal Academy. Until then, serious scholars hadn't suggested that birthright citizenship was controversial. But starting with a scholar called Ilan Warman, and then a bunch of other people chimed in, these scholars argued that the framers of the 14th Amendment didn't intend to grant citizenship to everyone born in the United States, but only those who were born and intended to be domiciled here. And they got that not from the text or even the original public meaning at the time of ratification, but a bunch of quotations about the specific things that people said on the floor of Congress. Mm-hmm. And then they said that meaning was kind of accepted by the 1880s and represented an alternative to the conventional understanding. What's so surprising about this is that it's not the way conservatives ordinarily say they're interpreting text, which is to look at what it meant at the time it was ratified. And as Chief Justice Roberts shows in his majority opinion, the common law understanding that we're born and take our citizenship from the place where we're born goes back to English common law. Chief Justice Roberts noted that Lincoln's attorney general had tried to put that in a law, and that the 14th Amendment, although its framer initially said otherwise, clearly intended to codify that common law ruling. Just one other thing that was really interesting. Justice Thomas had a remarkable conversation with Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Justice Jackson said this is an affirmation of the core ideals of the Declaration of Independence, which promise equality to all persons, regardless of race or creed. And Justice Thomas, quoting Justice John Marshall Harlan's dissenting opinion in Plessy versus Ferguson, emphasized that Justice Harlan thought that citizenship was should be limited to the freedmen and to African Americans. Of course, it was also Justice Thomas who had some notoriously racist things to say about Asian Americans, so it was an ambiguous quotation, but it showed that both Justice Thomas and Justice Jackson have completely different conceptions of the 14th Amendment, and they really were discussing it very seriously in this case.
And you mentioned Harlan there, who's one of the dissenters, I believe, one of the two dissenters in the case from 1898 that really established this idea that the 14th Amendment grants birthright citizenship. It's U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark. So back then, this is again 1898, there were, I believe, just two dissenting justices from this opinion, the opinion establishing that this man, Wong Kim Ark, was indeed an American citizen. So we've gone from two dissenters to that idea to possibly four. Is that right, Kate Shaw, that from 1898 to now, double the number of Supreme Court justices believe that possibly the 14th Amendment does not grant citizenship to most people born here? Do I have that right?
I think that the math is right. So two dissenters in Wong Kim Ark and four dissenters on the constitutional question in Trump versus Barbara, the name of the birthright citizenship case.
With the 14th Amendment never changing in text.
Never, yeah.
14th Amendment not changing. And, you know, I think that, you know, important precedent is a big part of, you know, the kind of the story of what the 14th Amendment means. But as Jeff was just suggesting, you have tons of contemporaneous, both drafting history and debates on the floor of Congress as the amendment is getting adopted and added to the Constitution. And then you had this unsettled, unbroken, rather settled practice of presidents, you know, executive branch officials, sort of the broader constitutional culture, accepting as this core feature of our democracy that everyone born here is American. Yeah. In some ways, that has distinguished us from other peer nations, essentially since the 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution. So it's not just this one Supreme Court opinion. There is just so much that would be upended if the Supreme Court did adopt the challenger's theory.
Look, and ultimately, the dissenters don't really have to explain how any of this would work because they didn't win in this case. But it boggles my mind a little bit, this idea that where you're domiciled or where you intend to stay is going to determine your citizenship status. Let me read this quote from Alito. The 14th Amendment confers citizenship on only those children who at birth owe allegiance solely to this country. In a world where you're trying to determine citizenship through whether a baby feels allegiance to one country or another, or whether an adult intends to domicile somewhere for 5-10 years or in perpetuity, I don't even understand how that would be workable, Jeffrey Rosen. Can you have the dissenters given us any clues into how they think this framework would work if indeed the 14th Amendment only applies to people who intend to stay here for some period of time?
Well, that was absolutely a concern of the majority. How on earth would you administer a rule that required case-by-case examination of whether someone's parents came here for so-called birthright tourism or actually intended to stay? And Justice Alito and Justice Thomas are clearly motivated by a policy concern. They have an awful lot of statistics about how birthright tourism, as they call it, is expanding and is a dramatic problem as they see it today in a way that it wasn't during the time of Reconstruction. And they want the 14th Amendment to evolve to take account of that. Now, that sounds an awful lot like the kind of living constitutionalism that these justices.
I was just going to say, that reminds me of the way some liberals talk about the Second Amendment. When the Second Amendment was written, we didn't have very powerful firearms. Therefore, the way it was written at the time, you can't just go strictly based on that text and that purpose. You need to update it. It sounds like now it's Alito and Thomas saying, well, the 14th Amendment, when they were written, you didn't have cheap airfare or whatever. Is that what they're saying, Jeff?
Well, they're saying that Congress and the president can take account of new challenges and can interpret the idea of jurisdiction accordingly. At the same time, they're saying that jurisdiction meant something different than everyone thought it did at the time that it was framed. You know, in a sense, it's a call to Congress to legislate on this question, although any such legislation would be unconstitutional in light of the majority decision. You'd need a constitutional amendment to change the majority's unequivocal affirmation of birthright citizenship. In practice, this should establish the idea of birthright citizenship for decades, you know, if not longer. Unless the composition of a court dramatically changes. But it's a very surprising interjection of policy concerns into what's supposed to be an originalist approach to constitutional interpretation.
Yeah, and we'll move on. But I did want to mention that Justice Brett Kavanaugh was that middle dissenter who agreed with the result that the president didn't have the power to upend birthright citizenship. But at the same time, he did not agree with the reasoning. He thought that if Congress created another statute that gave exceptions to birthright citizenship, that would be legal. And so, you know, I just want to throw that out there. It seems like he opened the door. And again, there's commentary about potentially bringing new lawsuits. So I want to move on and stay on the issue of immigration because there, you know, the case where a temporary protective status was basically ended. The court has allowed the Trump administration to end TPS for Haitian and Syrian nationals. They've ruled that TPS statutes generally bars judicial review of termination of decisions. Kate, I wanted to get could you just explain this ruling to us and the ripple effect to folks who are, because I know a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people will be impacted by this ruling and pretty quickly. Could you break down the decision and the impact?
Absolutely. So temporary protected status is kind of what it sounds like. It's a designation the executive branch can make to allow individuals who are already in the United States to remain here on this status because the conditions in their home countries are just too dangerous for them to be safely sent back there. So think, you know, natural disaster, civil war, things of that nature. So there are a number of countries under this TPS designation, and two of them, Haiti and Syria, were at issue in the case the court decided last week. The Trump administration ended or, you know, purported to end the TPS designations for both of those countries, in addition to many others. And these challengers argued both that the administration had violated statutory requirements for ending TPS, and also in the case of Haiti, that the administration was motivated by unconstitutional racial bias in the decision to terminate TPS. On the first of these, the majority of the court basically said that, as you said, courts don't have a say in whether the administration followed the right procedures in ending TPS. Those designations and those terminations are not judicially reviewable. So that applies to any TPS decision, not just this one. And then on the constitutional question, the plaintiffs had amassed a great deal of evidence of statements, in particular by the president and the Secretary of Homeland Security, evincing in the challengers' formulation pretty vile racist sentiment about individuals from Haiti, accusing them of doing things like poisoning the blood of the nation. And somehow the majority of the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Justice Alito, said basically that those were not overtly racial statements, and a general posture of opposition to immigration as opposed to kind of impermissible, unconstitutional, racist intent is what drove those decisions. And so the bottom line is the administration has ended the TPS designation for both Haiti and Syria, and its other terminations, not for every country, but for the vast majority of them, go into effect basically immediately, although there are a few other lawsuits pending. So that's over a million people in total affected by this decision.
Yeah, and Jeffrey Rosen, I mean, the ripple effect here, vast. And one of the things that stood out to me about this ruling is that it seems like people have limited rights, individuals. It seems like it limits the rights of individuals to sort of seek redress from the court. Did you take it that way, this ruling, at all?
It absolutely did. The core of the majority's holding is that the secretary's compliance with the statute is in every respect unreviewable by the courts. That means that people can never challenge their designation. Justice Kagan said in her dissent, in fact, the statute does allow judicial review of whether the secretary adhered to the right procedures, which is what was at issue here. And the second claim that was really striking is the majority saw no evidence that race played any role in the Haiti decision. Justice Kagan and Sotomayor and Jackson say it's plain from the president's statements that race did play a role. And what really jumped out at me is Justice Thomas, in his concurring opinion, went even further, and I think this is the first time I've seen him suggest this, and said the federal government isn't even bound by the Equal Protection Clause and not required to avoid race discrimination at all. There's a decision called Bowling versus Sharp from the Warren Court era that applied the Equal Protection Clause against Congress, even though it claims to bind only the states, and by radically suggesting that the federal government shouldn't have to abide by any equal protection guarantees, Justice Thomas opens the door to race discrimination of all kinds that's by the federal government that's completely unreviewable.
Was Thomas suggesting that that perhaps the equal protection framework would not apply here because of the individuals involved, because they are here temporarily, or was he saying really any executive action, it doesn't really matter, you could sort of violate the principles of equal protection, Jeff?
It's the latter. He makes the very broad claim that the Constitution has only one equal protection clause. It applies to the states, not the federal government. And that this case called Bowling versus Sharp, which applied the equal protection clause to the federal government, was wrongly decided. It's really surprising.
I'm just trying to make sure I understand this. So the federal government could explicitly take an action, make a law to hurt a racial group, say that they're doing it, but because it's the federal government and not a state, they would not necessarily be violated the Equal Protection Clause as Thomas interprets it.
I mean, I'd be interested if Kate thinks I'm missing anything, but that seems right to me. And for example, Woodrow Wilson's decision to segregate the federal government would be unreviewable, as would any race discrimination by the federal government, including, for example, the Trump Muslim ban, which the court did, in fact, review. So there's only one justice who's suggesting that now, but I've never seen that before in a Supreme Court opinion.
Kate, you're shaking your head up. Was that how you read it as well, or do you think there's some nuance here? I mean, again, it's just one justice, but obviously, like, these opinions matter. They influence, you know, future opinions and legal thinking in general. Just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think your question, Avi, was a really good one. There's a couple of places in the opinion where I do think that Justice Thomas sort of says there's no you know, constitutional claim here because these are non-citizens,
right,
bringing an equal protection claim against the federal government. But I also think that Jeff is right that that qualifier doesn't appear everywhere. Thomas talks about the federal government's, you know, kind of the irrelevance of the equal protection claim, because the 14th Amendment by its term says no state shall. So that's the states, not the federal government. As Jeff explained, this case called Bowling versus Sharp said, well, it can't be that the federal government can violate equality guarantees in a way that states can't. So it must be that the federal constitution, you know, constrains the federal government, yeah, maybe through the Fifth Amendment, which has a due process clause, but there's an equal protection component. So it gets a little technical. But I think that Thomas is basically raising a question about all of that. And I also think that he is the justice who most kind of plays the long game in seeding these very fringe legal ideas that come to amass more and more support. So I don't think we can dismiss this argument just because it's only for one justice.
Yeah. And Jeffrey, you said this earlier. I mean, the idea of birthright citizenship not saying, meaning what it says in the 14th Amendment was a fringe idea. And all of a sudden it made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And you have four justices sort of agreeing that the 14th Amendment doesn't say what it says. So, by the way, we'd love to hear from you. What's your reaction to the Supreme Court decisions this term? What ruling do you think will be most consequential? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook viewers, you can leave your comments in the live chat. I want to kind of move. We have about five more minutes in this segment before we have to go to break. But I got to talk about transgender athletes. There were two cases. The court held that Idaho and West Virginia may exclude trans athletes from girls and women's sports teams. Jeffrey, I'll start with you on this one. Just sort of your underlying understanding of this ruling and the impact. And I want to also sort of caveat, I want you to explain what it says, but also what it doesn't say. And you can go right ahead and explain that.
Well, the court says that 27 states who have excluded people who are biologically born male and transition to women from playing on women's teams, but doesn't do the same thing for those who are born biologically female, are consistent with the Equal Protection Clause. The court says that this is a form of sex discrimination, not discrimination based on transgender status, because whether or not you can play depends on your sex at birth. And the court says that this is subject to something called intermediate scrutiny, which requires that it be substantially related to an important governmental interest. And the court says the government does have important interests in leveling the playing field in sports and in taking account of the differences in strength between men and women, which the court says are real differences rather than based on stereotypes. The dissent disagrees. It says that transgender status, that it is a transgender discrimination against transgender people, that should be subject to higher forms of scrutiny, and that there should be some kind of individualized determination about whether or not a particular person is or isn't within the range of strength to be able to compete on the team. This is picking up on a decision called Scrimeti from last year, I think it was, where the court upholds the state laws that forbid puberty blockers for minors. And there again, the majority dismissed the idea that it was a form of transgender discrimination and also that transgender discrimination should be subject to heightened scrutiny. So I think we can safely say the court has twice said by a 6-3 vote that there's no special scrutiny for transgender status, and it will be more willing to take account of sex-based discriminations that affect transgender people when they think they're based on real biological differences.
And Kate, what did it get? Because one of the things that stood out to me was that the court basically says that bans on transgender athletes playing in women's sports are not unconstitutional, but it doesn't necessarily, and in response to that, you see a lot of anti-trans athletes groups saying they're going to challenge the states that allow it. Your thoughts on that take is, does it make the states that allow trans athletes to participate, does it make that somehow, does it question the legality of that part?
Well, this case itself doesn't call into question or doesn't resolve the challenges to those state schemes, but you're absolutely right that is the next question that's coming down the pike. And some of those cases are already pending, right? So what the court said here was that these bans on trans girls playing are not unconstitutional. They're also not in violation of a federal statute, Title IX. So these bans can stand under the court's decision, but it doesn't say anything about whether states, it says states may ban trans girls and women from playing, but it certainly doesn't say that they must. But those are kind of the challenges, the next kind of generation challenges that are now pending, which is individuals who want to force states that do let trans girls and women play to keep them from doing that. So I think that will be an uphill argument. I very much hope the Supreme Court turns those arguments away. It seems very difficult to me to, you know, fashion a responsible argument that the Constitution confers an entitlement to exclude trans athletes from playing. But there are also statutory Title IX arguments that say that states that don't ban trans athletes are hurting cis girls and women, and so the statute requires them to exclude. So I don't know ultimately how those cases are going to shake out either in the lower courts or in the Supreme Court, but I feel confident that in the next year or two, we're going to know much more because I am sure the court is going to get one of those cases.
So much more to come. Let me read a couple of comments that are going to get us into some of the cases we'll talk about on the other side of this break. Ruth says this term's decisions have been sharply skewed toward making Trump a unitary executive, something our founders definitely did not want. I think we'll talk about a couple of the cases that Ruth is referring to. And Leave Be Alone on YouTube says most consequential ruling, probably Republicans versus FEC, further freeing up money in elections. This is a further step in the wrong direction. We need money to have less influence in politics, not more.
Yeah.
We'll talk about those decisions on the other side of this break. You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Before we jump back into our conversation about the term Supreme Court rulings, it is time to reveal today's Giveaway Wednesday event. Al, hit it.
And those are the All-American Sounds of the World famous Preservation Hall Jazz Band. They're coming to town on Thursday, July 23rd for NOLA Night in King of Prussia as part of the Concerts Under the Stars series.
Yes, and two tickets to the show will run you $100. But the third, and again, the third person who emails studio2@whyy.org and asks for a pair of tickets will get them free, courtesy of Studio 2. Again, the third person who emails us, studio2@whyy.org, will get the tickets for free.
Now back to our conversation about the major Supreme Court decisions this term and their potential impact. Let me reintroduce our guest. Kate Shaw is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania and co-host of the Strict Scrutiny podcast. And Jeffrey Rosen is a law professor at George Washington University, CEO emeritus of the National Constitution Center, and author of The Pursuit of Liberty.
Yes, and of course, listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What's your reaction to the U.S. Supreme Court decisions this term? And what rulings do you think will be most consequential? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And hello to our YouTube and Facebook viewers. You can leave those comments in the live chat.
John says, I agree with the court's ruling on birthright citizenship, but John also agrees that Justice Thomas's concerns are valid. To address his points, John says, do away with dual citizenship. Perhaps a conversation for another day. Let's talk about executive power. A couple of key cases here, Trump versus Slaughter and Trump versus Cook. This has to do with whether or not the president can fire independent, or maybe not so much anymore, regulators. Kate, what did the court say here? And how do we make sense of it? Because does feel like we're getting tugged in a couple directions here when it comes to executive authority.
Definitely. So first, Humphrey's executor, the case that involved overruling Humphrey's executor, this nearly century old opinion, and affirming in this current case that the president has the power not unlimited, because we'll get to the Fed case in a minute, but virtually unlimited to fire the heads of even traditionally independent agencies. So at issue in the Slaughter case was the Federal Trade Commission, this regulator that does consumer protection and antitrust enforcement. But there are a lot of other agencies, the National Labor Relations Board, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and many others that by design have leaders, right, heads of the agency who are protected somewhat from presidential control. So they can't be fired by statute. They can't be fired by the president unless there is some cause. So some reason that the president provides, can't just fire them because he wants somebody else in the job. And so for nearly 100 years, the Supreme Court has affirmed that the Constitution allows agencies to be structured in that way, and that there may be good reasons to sometimes insulate these agencies to a degree from presidential control. And the Supreme Court, in the Slaughter opinion, repudiated that history, overruled the Humphreys executor case, and basically said the president has free rein when it comes to firing the heads of even these traditionally independent agencies. Article 2 of the Constitution gives the president the executive power, all of it, according to the court. And so he has to have the ability to fire immediately anybody who he loses confidence in, and statutes that undermine that authority are fundamentally inconsistent with the separation of power. So it is an enormous ruling when it comes to the face of the federal government, which has, you know, for a century or really more in certain respects, had built into it these kind of areas of pockets of independence from the president. And after Slaughter, that is no longer the case.
Yeah. However, somehow the Federal Reserve is excluded from this. I just constitutionally, Jeffrey, how do we get there? Because it's, as a layperson, very difficult to understand why this one thing would be insulated from all of what Kate just laid out.
Well, the court says that it's a special history involving the Bank of the United States and the battle between Hamilton and Jefferson. And okay. I like this very much because my new book is about exactly this question. But it's true that Hamilton and Jefferson disagreed about whether Congress had the power to charter the Bank of the United States, which had a combination of public and private directors. And Jefferson said it was unconstitutional. Hamilton said it wasn't. And Chief Justice Marshall, in the landmark decision of McCulloch versus Maryland, upheld the Bank of the United States with a liberal construction of the Constitution. And the court said that that understanding was liquidated, to use the technical term. In other words, it came to be accepted by subsequent generations, including by President Madison, who changed his mind about the constitutionality of the bank. So in light of this long unbroken history of acceptance and the fact that the bank doesn't exercise executive functions and that the economy would collapse if we didn't have an independent bank, and that was a pragmatic concern the court stressed, the court said the Fed is different and you can have for cause requirements. The dissent objected and said there's no principled basis for this distinction. In fact, the same Congresses that created the Bank of the United States also created independent agencies like the Sinking Fund, or an independent controller of the Treasury that James Madison supported, and went on to create independent agencies throughout the 19th century and, of course, in the Progressive Era under Woodrow Wilson, when most of the modern administrative agencies were created. This is another case of history meaning completely different things based on the lens that you choose. And the dissent accuses the majority in this case of playing whack-a-mole with history and taking a text out of context and expanding executive power far beyond what even Alexander Hamilton would have wanted, because it was Hamilton who used the phrase unitary executive in his Pacificus letters. To make things even more confusing, Hamilton seems to have changed his mind about whether or not the president could be constrained in his firing. So the point is that history is complicated. It is nuanced. That's what makes it so exciting and interesting to learn about. But we're seeing in these momentous decisions that you can have a completely different vision of what history says based on the quotes you choose and the perspectives that you adopt.
And by the way, First Bank of the United States, right here in Philadelphia, open to the public today for the first time in over 50 years. We just have to add that as a footnote, as the legal scholars say.
Absolutely.
So exciting.
And because I want to make sure we get a chance to put all of these rulings in context, I want to move on to the ruling about campaign coordinated spending between political parties and candidates. 6-3 decision there, potentially transforming how campaigns raise and spend money. And Kate, could you explain this ruling? And then just the ripple effect, because there had been these limits and now we're going into the midterms, we're going into another presidential election in 2028. And now it seems like a lot more money can be poured into politics.
Well, at least a lot more money can be poured in a particular way into politics, right? So this is a case that struck down one of the last remaining vestiges of federal campaign finance law, a law that had limited the amount of money political parties can spend in coordination with candidates. And the Supreme Court said, as it has said almost every time it's confronted a campaign finance regulation in recent years, that the limitation violates the First Amendment. Parties have First Amendment rights to speak. Candidates have First Amendment rights to coordinate with parties. And this limitation undermines those constitutional interests. But there's also this kind of pragmatic dimension to the court's reasoning, which is that you have these, you've had these super PACs that have developed outside of the candidate and party structure. And super PACs, of course, are sources of enormous campaign spending. And it's actually problematic for there to be these constraints on candidates and parties when super PACs are so unconstrained in their ability to spend. And so in the view of the majority, there's actually this way that invalidating this limitation that continues to exist will help democracy, and that it will let kind of stronger parties emerge and flourish, and that that will ultimately be better for democracy than a system with weak parties, but these strong, very well-funded outside interests. And that's not at all a crazy argument. But in some ways, the court itself has distorted the campaign finance landscape pretty dramatically through its decisions beginning in Citizens United and the ones that followed that, and now has said, well, the campaign finance landscape looks the way it looks today, and that's bad for parties, and so we should invalidate this additional restriction. So I actually think this is a more mixed result in terms of whether it's a good idea as a policy matter, but the First Amendment maximalism on display in all of the Supreme Court's first campaign finance decisions is, to my mind, deeply problematic.
Yeah,
it's sort of the meme. We're all trying to find the guy who did this. Anyways, 100%. I do wonder, though, what's left, I guess, on the horizon when it comes to campaign finance, Jeffrey Rosen, because at this point, now we've done away with some restrictions that have to do with how much you can give to a party, and that the party could coordinate with a candidate, and we've got these super PACs. I mean, there are still limits, though, I guess, on what you can directly give to a candidate, is my understanding. And is there any reason to think those limits would be abolished at some point under the same theories that the other limits have been abolished under? Or is that separate and untouchable? I mean, what's next, I suppose?
Well, First Amendment maximalists, as Kate well says, would overturn the Buckley versus Filio decision, which distinguished between contributions and expenditures, and say that neither could be limited. The court hasn't yet gone full force against Buckley. It's been chipping away at it case by case, but this is definitely a move in that direction, and we'll see whether or not there are five votes to overturn Buckley. We should say here that the First Amendment maximalist position is not an exclusively conservative one. There are distinguished civil libertarians like Nadine Strossen, a senior fellow at FIRE, as I am now, the great Philadelphia-based defender of free speech, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, who think that Citizens United was correctly decided, because she is a First Amendment maximalist in all situations. So it doesn't have a complete party valence here, but huge consequences for the American political system. And if Buckley is overturned, there would be no limits on spending in campaigns.
Yeah. And so I want to zoom out for a second, because we didn't talk about the mail-in ballots case, by the way, where the court upheld Mississippi's grace period for mail ballots postmarked by Election Day. And so I want to zoom with that case in mind and the other cases in this term and sort of zoom out, take a step back, and just sort of talk about the through lines here, because I want to get each of your takes on what you think the Supreme Court is saying about where power belongs in America right now, because we talked about how it seems like individuals don't necessarily have the power. It seems like things that was originally left to Congress with regard to independent agencies no longer has the power, and yet we have this unitary executive. your thoughts. And we only have about 2 minutes left in this the show. And just each of you take a minute. And where do you what do you think the through line is through all the decisions you've seen from this court? Kate, we'll start with you and then we'll give Jeffrey the last word.
Sure. In terms of where power resides in the view of the Supreme Court, I think it resides with itself. I mean, I think that a big kind of through line of this term is the court really flexing its muscles. It will decide all of these core features of our democracy, whether we haven't talked about the Voting Rights Act. Obviously, that decision goes back a couple of months, but the court essentially invalidating the last key provision of the Voting Rights Act in Louisiana versus Calais. So whether the law should ensure political power by racial minorities, whether agencies should be somewhat independent from complete presidential control. In both of those cases, lawmakers said yes. The court here just disagreed and imposed its view on all of us. So I think the power in the court's view resides mostly with the court, and I would say secondarily with the president. And it's not that interested in a lot of power residing in Congress and independent agencies or really anywhere else.
Mm. Yeah, not even the people. Yeah, go ahead, Jeffrey.
I agree with Kate that this is a court that's determined to expand its own power. And of course, in the process, it's expanding presidential power in a way that the framers would not have recognized. Now, there was an interesting concurrence by Justice Gorsuch in the Trump and Slaughter case that said Congress has wrongly delegated too much power to the president, and we should and wouldn't have done so if it knew that the president could exercise that power without checks. Therefore, we, the court, should go back and strike down some more aspects of the independent agencies as doing too much without checking the president. In practice, that's not likely to happen. It is a vision of the separation of powers, but it's an accurate acknowledgement about the fact that the framers' view of the separation of powers, which is that Congress would be the most dangerous branch, the president would execute Congress's will, and the judiciary would be the least dangerous branch, is now completely out of whack.
Mm. Well, there's the final word from Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at George Washington University, CEO emeritus of the National Constitution Center, and author of The Pursuit of Liberty. Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And thank you, Kate Shaw, law professor at Penn and co-host of the Strict Scrutiny podcast. Kate, it's always good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, and of course, we have to thank our producers, Debbie Bilder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Thanks to Mike Schiffler and Tina Calliquet, our visual producers, and Al Banks, engineered today's show. So thank you, Al. And our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolf-Manero.